of the day. The United States versus Bonsu. Mr. Willis.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stanish Willis on behalf of Seth Bonsu. This is an appeal of a conviction of 8 counts of an indictment, 1 count for conspiracy to distribute narcotics, and 7 counts of actual distribution. Mr. Bonsu raised 4 issues in his appeal. I'm going to start off with the sentencing issues. Let me review some of the facts that are relevant to the case that I've outlined in the brief. I just want to amplify them a little bit. Mr. Bonsu is a very unusual case. In fact, the trial court judge acknowledged that his case was a case that was outside of the heartland.
He didn't, right? If we're talking about the application of the safety valve, the trial court judge was scrupulous to try to investigate Mr. Bonsu's competency, but he then focused on the time period after he's been certified as restored to competency by the appropriate officials, and you don't challenge that finding, I take it.
I do challenge that finding.
You think he was never competent?
No, I don't.
So that's what I'm trying to focus on. You agree that he was competent?
He was competent for a period of time, and then he was found not competent twice.
But then he came back again, and he was competent.
And he was competent, and then he went back again. There were two hearings that determined that he was incompetent.
Right. No, but are you arguing he was incompetent at the time of his trial?
No.
All right. That's what I'm trying to get at. So we agree there comes a moment when he's competent again.
That's correct. Absolutely.
With all this other, I agree. There was a lot of back and forth before that moment.
But I thought
it was that moment at which Judge Gettleman began to evaluate this and said, okay, what's his cooperation now? Is he in fact sort of going back to whatever cooperative posture he may have had before the competency issues arose? And Judge Gettleman says no, and actually holds a whole hearing on some of these allegations.
Judge, there were two. I think the issues began to get confused. We raised the issue of the safety valve. We also raised the issue of a downward departure pursuant to 5K1.0.
But why do we have jurisdiction to review a discretionary decision not to give a downward departure?
Because in this court's case in Eakinland, the court decided that if there were questions of law or questions of the trial court's construing of the law, then this court has the obligation to review. In this case, I submit, and again, getting back to the downward departure, because I don't want to confuse those two. The court with the downward departure, remember, this is a case where a man had been found incompetent twice. During a 3-year period, he had fired four lawyers. He had initially cooperated with the government extensively. As soon as he was arrested, he began to cooperate. He began to make phone calls to co-defendants. He had extensive interviews with the government agents. He appeared before the grand jury. And then at some point, he stopped doing that. And he stopped doing that based on the expert testimony because he developed a personality disorder. One of the experts characterized it as he was delusional, he was paranoid, he was suspicious. And the way that that played itself out was he didn't trust his lawyer. He thought his lawyer was conspiring with the government. He didn't trust the government anymore. He was very meticulous about details related to his case. So whenever he began to discuss his case, this paranoid personality manifested itself. Now, with regards to the downward departure, the district court judge applied the wrong standard. We were not talking about the standard of 5K2.13. That's a special section. It has to do with diminished capacity. And it has to do with diminished capacity during the time of the offense.
Right. I think the district court judge knew just what you were talking about, and he just found that even if there were a case out there where somebody was trying for the 5K2.0 downward departure, yours wasn't the case, or Mr. Bonsu's, I should say, wasn't the case, in that when he was restored once and for all to competency, he continued to insist that, he still is insisting, that his grand jury testimony was all coerced and untruthful, and the district court didn't believe that. He actually made a determination that that wasn't the case, and so he thought he was not, in fact, cooperating.
Well, what the judge says, and this is in the appendix, is that he starts off on page 11 saying that this case is outside of the heartland, and then he goes on, this is near the last paragraph, I never had a case like this where a man did what Mr. Bonsu did at the point of incompetency. In the next paragraph, last sentence, it was in the heartland at the time of the offense.
Well, he says, again, the fact that he was restored to competence and put the government to its proof puts it back into the heartland, in a sense. So he sort of deletes this intermediate period.
But the problem, Judge, is on the next page, he talks about, in the second paragraph, what I think you have to look at is he's outside the heartland at crucial moments, and that was the moment of the crime, and the moment he went to trial. When the trial court judge talks about the moment of the crime, that suggests to me he's going back to 5K13.
Well, no, he says, what I think you have to look at is, and then there's sort of an implicit comma, is he outside the heartland at the crucial moment? And that was the moment of the crime and the moment he went to trial. He wasn't. And then he's just sort of looking at everything. I don't think he's talking about 2.13. And I think, unless you can show that he's misinterpreting as a matter of law the scope of 5K2.0.
I think he this language, diminished capacity, is 5.13 language. The government uses it.
I know where it is in 5.13.
Our point here is on the Kuhn. Kuhn says that this inquiry is very fact specific. You have to look at the totality, essentially, of the conduct. We're not just looking at the fact that Mr. Bonsu had a personality disorder. That's one of the main factors. The other factors are, for example, that he cooperated with the government, that he would have continued to cooperate had he not suffered from disorder. The result of that was he ended up going to the hospital. The people he was cooperating against went to trial while he was incompetent. They were sentenced. Convicted and sentenced, and when he returned, there was nobody to cooperate against. This is a case where I would argue that this is a very rare case where a person pulls out of his plea agreement. That's not rare, but pulls out of it not because of any other reason other than he's ill. He has a personality disorder. That's why he pulled out. Had he not had the personality disorder, he would have continued, arguably, to cooperate, and he would have benefited from that. The end result was he goes to trial instead of getting 60 months, which he would have gotten had he not been ill. He ends up getting 130 months. So that's why this is out of the heartland, not just because he was ill, but because of the fact that he cooperated and his illness caused him to lose the benefits of his cooperation because he wasn't able to continue to cooperate. That's why it's outside of Harlan, and that's why I think the trial judge missed it, because he focused only on the illness. He talked about diminished capacity, and I believe he used the wrong standard, because the government used the wrong standard. They actually cite 5213, and I think that language threw the judge off.
As long as there's no error in the interpretation of the guideline, though, under your theory, I guess, you think that Kuhn means that there's an appeal every time the district court decides not to make a downward departure, an appeal on abuse of discretion, and that would require overruling.
No, Judge, I don't think that. I think Kuhn says, and I think it means in this case, there would be appeal under Ekelin if the judge misconstrues this particular provision. I think he did. I think he used the wrong standard. I think he used 513 when he should have used 5K2.0. If he had used that, then he would have been looking at all these factors that I just enumerated. He would have looked at not just the disorder, and maybe I shouldn't even call it diminished capacity, because that confuses everything. I think confuses the government. He looked at diminished capacity or the personality disorder, but then what made it out of the heartland, not just that, was the end result, the fact that he couldn't cooperate, and he couldn't cooperate because of his illness, and he lost the benefit of that bargain. He increased his sentence or his exposure 100%. That's what took it out of the heartland. I mean, we have defendants all the time enter plea agreements and change their mind and go to trial. That's heartland. That happens all the time. But when they enter a plea agreement and cooperate, this is unlike the case that the government cited. He was truthful about everything he gave. In fact, the information he gave the government prior to his becoming ill was the information they used to convict his co-defendants. So this is different from the Marine case, for example, where the defendant constantly lied and he had to go back repeatedly until he got his story consistent with the government's evidence. Mr. Bonzu cooperated truthfully, and he became ill, and as a result of that, he couldn't cooperate. He didn't have capacity, according to the experts. And as an end result of that, co-defendants go to trial, they get sentenced, then he gets competent again. He's restored, and once he's restored, then he can't cooperate against them, obviously, not in a real way. So we think the judge is incorrect because he used the wrong standard. Had he used the broader Kuhn standard, and Kuhn is very specific about the looking at the facts, looking at the defendants and the surrounding circumstances, and I don't think this judge did that, because you don't have to do that on the 513. All you have to do on the 513 is you got diminished capacity, you have your client examined by the forensic psychologist, the psychiatrist, and you come in and say he's during the time of the commission of the crime, he didn't have the capacity. That's it. And I think the judge tended to mix those standards. That's why I think this court has an obligation to review it. Regarding the safety valve, I think that's much simpler. The safety valve should be given to a defendant, and the court is authorized to give it when the defendant meets the five requirements of 5C. It's undisputed that Mr. Bonzu met all the requirements, and it's disputed whether he provided truthful information. Again, he provided truthful information throughout until he became ill, but the critical factor here is 2 or 3 weeks before we went to sentencing, we offered Mr. Bonzu, said we want to come over and talk to the government. The government wouldn't talk to him. At sentencing, we said we're willing to talk to the government. 5C says that a defendant can offer truthful information all the way to the time of sentencing. We tried to offer that even before sentencing. What the trial court judge said is that regarding safety valve, he again limited it to the time that Mr. Bonzu became competent. On page 10, he says that, the last full paragraph, the problem talking to me, with all due respect, he said I did a wonderful job and all that, I agree with that. He said, I found him competent. And then he says, when he came back in January competent, he didn't reach out to the government at that point. That's not what the rule says. He doesn't have to reach out at that point. He has to reach out by the time of sentencing, or even at sentencing. I think this court has construed to mean he should reach out just before sentencing because he's reaching out to the government, not to the trial judge. He reached out before sentencing, and he reached out at sentencing. But as a practical matter, there was nothing that he could cooperate with the government on. That's why they didn't want to talk with him, because the co-defendants had gone to trial had been sentenced. But the trial judge was incorrect because, again, he stopped at the time that Mr. Bonzo became competent, and that's not the criteria. The criteria is he became competent in January, the trial was in May. He had up until May, the day of the sentencing, or prior to that, and that's what he did. And I think because of that, this should be remanded on the sentencing issues, and I reserve additional time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Mr. Sinnerford?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm John Sinnerford. I represent the United States in this matter. I would like to address the two issues that counsel raised in his argument today. First, with respect to the district court's denial of the defendant's motion for a departure under Rule 5K2.0, this court lacks jurisdiction to review that decision because the district court recognized its authority to depart on the basis that the defendant requested. Specifically, the district court recognized that it had authority in an appropriate case where a defendant's incompetence interferes with his ability to cooperate, that the district court did have that authority to depart, but found that this was not an appropriate case because the defendant was restored to competency and continued to choose to make false claims that he was coerced into giving false testimony at the grand jury. The district court did not confuse the 5K2.0 standard with the 5K2.13 standard. In fact, under the case law, under 5K2.13, the court can only consider the state of mind of the defendant at the time of the offense. The district court specifically considered the state of mind of the defendant not only at the time of the offense, but also at the time he was restored to competency. For that reason, the court lacks jurisdiction in this case. Even if there were a finding that the district court even if there were a finding that this court has jurisdiction to review the district court's decision, the decision was not an abuse of discretion. Rule 5K2.13 is relevant to the extent that it defines a specific circumstance in which mental capacity is relevant. The guidelines find that this particular issue is relevant specifically at the time of the offense. Under Kuhn, instances of departure that are not specifically related in the guidelines will be extremely rare. And in this case, such a departure was not appropriate, specifically, once again, because the defendant continued to refuse to cooperate after he was restored to competency and persisted in his false statements. With respect to the safety valve issue, once again, the district court did not commit clear error in finding that the defendant was not eligible for the safety valve.
The safety valve is something that requires sort of some totality of evaluation of the cooperation of the defendant, or would it be enough for somebody to be absolutely silent and then 2 minutes before the district judge pronounces sentence come in and present an enormous stack of materials and say, okay, I'm ready to talk?
The government's position is that the district court should look at the state of the record at the time of sentencing. And in this case, we have a situation where the defendant initially provided truthful cooperation, but then retracted that cooperation and made specific false statements that the defendant never attempted to take back.
Even up to the time of sentence, you're referring to the hearing the district court conducted about the grand jury?
That's correct. And not only the hearing, but also numerous filings made by the defendant, both pro se and through counsel, where the defendant repeatedly claimed that he had been coerced by both the assistant U.S. attorney as well as the FBI agent into providing false testimony before the grand jury. The defendant made such claims during a time that he was incompetent, but also persisted in those claims after he was restored to competency, and in fact has continued to persist in those claims to this day. Because the defendant was persisting in false claims at the time of the sentencing, he was not eligible for the safety valve. And I would like to clarify one specific point that counsel raised today. At the sentencing hearing, counsel did indicate that he had indicated a willingness to come and tell the government whatever information was left to be told. However, there's no indication that the defendant intended to retract his false statements. There is a good faith requirement under the safety valve, and the defendant needed to establish that he was willing to retract those statements. The government's under no obligation in a situation where the defendant is maintaining a false position up to and including the sentencing hearing to nonetheless bring the defendant in for a proffer interview. For the reasons I've stated and for the reasons stated in the government's brief, I would request that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Willis, your time has expired, but you may have a minute if you wish to rebut.
Just simply, 5C1 says, no later than the time of the sentencing hearing. And again, this court has interpreted that to mean not before the judge, but the offer should be made to the government. We made a phone call, we outlined in a brief to the government. They didn't want to talk to Mr. Bunzu for obvious reasons. There was nothing to talk about because his co-defendants had gone to trial and had been found guilty and was sentenced. And we made an offer at the sentencing. And I think that's all we require, especially the offer prior to sentencing. And so I asked the court to, on the issues of sentencing, to remand back to the district court judge on the issues that we outlined and argued in our brief related to insufficiency of evidence. We asked the court to reverse. Thank you very much.
All right. thank you, Mr. Willis. And I want to give an additional thanks.